This Tuesday marks the beginning of the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, the eight-day festival of lights where families gather each night to light one more candle on their menorah. The festival has its roots in the Hebrew scripture book of Maccabees, which tells a story that may seem too familiar to those of us living today. For imagine that everything you held dear about your world had been turned upside down. Your government seemed to be against you. Your most sacred places were threatened by false idols. National monuments were being shrunk for some reason. And your own people were divided, some standing with those who would hoard power, turning their backs on the rest of us. This was the state of the Jewish people in the second century. Their holy land had been invaded by a Syrian Greek empire that had decreed that the Jewish religion was to be outlawed. And the temple, the most sacred place, the most holy of grounds, was defiled. The empire had brought in statues of their gods, statues of Zeus, to place in the temple, a place for that the Jewish people would never put any idol whatsoever. But instead of submitting to the powers that be, one of the priests from the Maccabee family refused to make a sacrifice to this Greek idol and fled with his family out into the wilderness, where he and his sons and his family waged an armed guerrilla war movement against the empire for years, trying to get it all back. Now, here's the thing. As we're hearing a story like that, all of us are biologically programmed to empathize with the underdog in the situation. And because we know that they eventually won, this part of the story, this years of war and battle, can easily be skipped over. But I don't think we can. Because they were outnumbered, thousands to one. If my pal C-3PO was around at the time, he would have said the odds of succeeding were 5,024,000 to one. It did not look good. And yet something within them wouldn't let them not take the wager to try. Think about it. What would you do if you were them? Could you hope? Everything you valued and hold dear has been taken away or soon would be. What would you do? For when is accepting reality complacency or common sense? When is insisting that things can be different a form of misplaced optimism? All of us have these moments in our lives, right? I mean, not exactly like that, but similar. When an uncertain future meets us in the present and asks us, what are you going to do? When we encounter that still small voice inside of ourselves that says, it doesn't have to be like this, but you can't imagine how you could make that a reality. You can't even imagine what the first step would be. You don't even know if it would be worth it. How you could leave, how you could start, how you could combat the forces that are against you. Since 1840, the frequency of the use of the word hope in the English language has declined by 50%. Which sort of makes sense. In that span of time, we have witnessed an American Civil War, two world wars, countless genocides, the rise and fall and rise again of fascism. Even despite the deep advances that we've made in those decades, women and people of color getting the vote, a stunning decrease in overall world violence, the explosion of literary rates, the flourishing of democracies, and what I've come to call as the recent slight pruning of the tree of misogyny that we've been seeing in the last few weeks. trying to figure out a catchy name for everything in the news. And that's what I came up with. If you have something better, let me know. Despite all of that, as we sung this morning, hope can indeed be hard to find. Hope is that power to hold on to the world as it is and as it could be, and not turn your back no matter what. Hope is hard work. And that's why most of us, including myself, usually settle for the two cheaper knockoff versions that we pretend are hope. That being hope, optimism, and complacency. So, do you know what drunk goggles are? Half of the first service didn't know, so I had to explain it, but I'll pretend that you don't know. So drunk goggles are these things that you put on your eyes, and it distorts your vision like you're intoxicated. I had to wear these when we were in school and we were doing the anti-drinking and driving campaigns. Because when you would put it on and try to walk in a straight line, most of the time you would like fall over because your vision was distorted enough that you couldn't figure out what was really happening. I sort of think of optimism like drunk goggles. We put them on, and it sort of distorts reality, allowing us to pretend that whatever we see, well, it'll be okay. Now, on the other hand, the other cheap knockoff version of hope that I sometimes cling to is complacency. And I think of complacency as the combination of the world's worst alarm clock attached to the world's most comfortable bed. For when it does happen to wake you up, the alarm clock, instead of insisting that you leave the bed's comfortable embrace, it just whispers to you and says, "Don't worry. Everyone else is just as comfortable as you are. What's the rush?" Or maybe even worse, what could you actually do? I think hope lives in the vast chasm where optimism and complacency cannot enter. And if you're like me, I cling to my goggles and pine for that bed because they are luxuries which theologian Miguel de la Torre reminds us that I can have because of my privilege. For those that society forces to the margins, if they are to survive, they have to see reality without distortion. And they cannot stay out of the action because their lives depend on it. I used to love this oft-quoted saying by the Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. Parker was a 19th century abolitionist who lived in New England. And you probably have heard this quote, as Martin Luther King has echoed it, and so has Barack Obama, that the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Now, when I heard that over and over again, I always thought it was a statement of fact. And from that comfortable bed or with those goggles on, it sure seems like it if you come from a place of privilege. But when I found in seminary the full quotation from Parker, I realized that it was something far more radical. For Parker says in full, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a very long one. My eyes reach but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." Parker's statement was not about the truth of the world verifiably moving towards justice, but a statement of faith. A deep trust beyond calculation that without being able to see the big picture or fast-forwarding to the end of history and seeing the arc of the universe finally come down fully on the side of justice, something in Parker's life, Something in the small daily interactions convicted him and divined that the universe, its trajectory, was towards goodness. Recently, I have been reading a lot about ants. It's my favorite segue in this sermon. And the little creepy crawly ones, not your relatives. Because I've become fascinated by the concept of biological emergence. Emergence is this phenomenon where a larger entity arises from smaller or simpler ones, and yet the large entity exhibits capacities or abilities beyond that of any of the individual ones. So think about those swarms of birds that you see dancing together in the sky, how they're able to not collide into one another as they dance and eat, how they're able to find swarms of insects together and yet do so in such a beautiful way. That is an example of emergence, which brings me back to ants. So, and you're seeing that I'm a complete nerd, so I feel like we've established it, but for those of you who are new, welcome. So there's about 10,000 species of ants in the world, and one thing that they all have in common is they all live in colonies. There's no such thing as a solitary ant. And every one of them, inside those colonies, no matter the size, and some colonies are thousands of ants, and some colonies are up to 300 million ants, which is completely disconcerting. Inside the colony, there are millions of ants going about all of the actions that are needed to keep the colony alive. They're gathering food, they're building the nest, they're protecting the queen. And one amazing thing about ants is that if you look at every interaction between every ant, those millions of connections, not once will any ant tell another ant what to do. Now, I always thought, as scientists did for a long time, that the queen ant was sort of the colony's supercomputer, telling the ants what to do. Oh, we need more food. Go get the food. Oh, we need to repair that. Go to that. Oh, someone's attacking. I don't know. Man the gates. But apparently, all the queen does is lay eggs all day. That's the full-time job. And there's no, like, level of middle management in the ant colony either. No ant ever dictates the behavior of another ant ever. Just imagine if you tried to run your household or workplace like that. Maybe a bit chaotic. But somehow ants have figured out as a collective, without directions, somehow their ability to adjust to changing environmental factors and needs, shifting the allocation of workers to perform specific tasks needed for survival. If the nest is damaged, they deploy the repair crew. If they found a great picnic, they send extra harvesters. But it's not so much that the ants are deployed, but rather that the ants deploy themselves. And so scientists wondered, how does an individual ant figure out what to do? Well, apparently it comes down to a very simple process. When two ants meet, they do a little antenna high five, which shares a crucial piece of information, simply what the other ant was doing. High five, oh, you were out getting food. High five, oh, you were repairing the nest. It's that simple. And each individual ant measures the number of high fives it gets. And if it counts more than usual harvester high fives, it tells them something. It tells them that maybe, A, the colony needs more food, so maybe I should go and get food, or B, maybe we found a great picnic, we should go over there. And sure, it's really super haphazard. One of the researchers that I was listening to says that one of the things that you realize when you study ants is that you really want to help them, because they do it really inefficiently. But I think it's really beautiful. Each ant decides for themselves if they will venture into the world and what they should do for the good of the colony based on a limited set of information. And yet, because each ant is doing it, it contributes to this deeper collective intelligence that has allowed ants to thrive on virtually every continent. They have become so prolific at adapting to their environment that if you put all of the animals in the world on a scale, a quarter of the weight would be made up from ants. A quarter. Elephants are heavy. Now, our lives are not as simple as ants. We take in much more information, and we live in a morally pluralistic and complex world. An individual ant computes a decision. We, on the other hand, have to choose. But like an ant colony, hope is something that we have to do together. Hope is a collective experience. For this world is too confusing and filled with too much pain for any one of us to carry it by ourselves. For the anatomy of hope is thousands of small, microscopic choices and moments. When a person holds fast to the knowing that the world doesn't have to be like this and decides to act. David Henderson writes that hope has a trump card, the capacity of the human heart. When optimism gets ground up by reality, hope goes toe-to-toe with reality because of a heart that simply refuses to quit. And there is no reality that can overcome the capacity of the human heart to withstand and even boldly ask, is that all you've got? Is that the best you can do? Now, I know in my life, and maybe in yours, I have encountered many moments in which I have not felt like I could ask life, is that all you've got? There are many times in my life in which I have not been hopeful. But the beautiful paradox of hope is that you don't need to be hopeful, because we do hope together. And the power of another's heart is enough if we just let it. Which is what the Maccabees did back in the second century. They bared witness to the spark of the possible. They refused to turn their backs. And they eventually, after battle against all odds, prevailed, so that they could finally enter once again the temple in Jerusalem, their most sacred ground, and they could begin the holy work of rededicating it to God. Which is where we catch up with the Hanukkah story that probably most of you are most familiar with. For when one of the priests was going into the temple to rededicate it, to light the eternal flame once again, the flame that is always supposed to be burning in the temple that represents the presence of God, the priest found that there was only enough oil for one day. And you probably know the miracle that happens next, that even though the oil was enough for one day, its light burned for eight, just enough time for new oil to be prepared. But here's my favorite part of that story. That priest that approached the menorah and saw the lack of oil made a choice. He didn't wait till they had secured oil to keep the flame alive. He lit it anyways. He trusted, he hoped, that the light of this moment, built upon all of the others, would be enough. And it was. And so we are left to trust as well. That when the earth and the world turn sour, and things seemed more doomed than usual, when the prospects for peace to reside in the Holy Land today in the 21st century are more threatened by the choices of our government, we are left to trust that we can divine the arc of the universe in micro moments of faith, and that we can borrow and create faith and hope with each other. For here's the challenge for all of us, And the good news is you don't need to be hopeful or hopeless. When hope is a collective creation, the opportunity for all of us, and I think it is a beautiful one, is to simply witness our fellow pilgrims on the road defiantly acting despite the odds. And when we meet them on the road, we get to do that equivalent of the ant high five and borrow some of their resolve, sharing ours, changing the calculus of hope for all of us. The vision for the world as it might be is only a spark. In doing our part in each choice, knowing that one day our descendants might begin to come across more and more people doing likewise, making it more likely that they will venture out deeper into the chasm of hope. Our challenge is to trust that even in the mystery and the mess, the hopelessness and the likelihood of failure, that someone will come along and say, there is danger that way. There is food that way. I'll go with you. Our hearts can take it. Here, share a bit of my hope. May it be so. And amen.